The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Well, we are pleased this morning to have one of our favorite guests, and we're kind of front-running, I think, a call that he has about midday today. But so we're going to get the news first, I guess. And so anyway, we're happy to have with us today Mr. Jack Ablin. Jack is Executive Vice President, Chief Investment Officer with BMO Private Bank. As head of macro strategy, he chairs the Asset Allocation Committee and is responsible for establishing investment policy and strategy within BMO Private Bank. He's also the author of a really good book called Reading Minds in Markets, Minimizing Risk and Maximizing Returns in a Volatile Global Marketplace. That was published in July 2009 by FT Press. It was on Wall Street Journal's bestseller list in 2009. So we're pleased to have again with us this morning Mr. Jack Ablin. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mike.
All right, Peggy wants to know, are you in Chicago or Florida?
No, I'm in Chicago, although I should be in Florida. It's about 40 degrees here right now.
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah, okay. They were discussing that this morning, how you hang out in Florida now because you don't like the cold in Chicago.
So. Yeah. Had I known it would be 40, I would be in Florida right now.
All right. So anyway, okay, you know, we've got Fed minutes coming out today. I don't guess we can have any conversation without talking about the Fed. But there seems to be less of an appetite right now for a June raise. In fact, I never thought there was a good chance of it. Maybe September, but I'm hearing this morning or reading this morning for the first time, they're talking about January of next year. What is your thoughts? What do you think the Fed is going to do?
Well, that those remarks came from Charles Evans, who the January stuff came from Charles Evans, who is probably among the most dovish Fed governors out there. He's our Chicago governor. I think he at one point said that, you know, his target inflation rate isn't 2, it's closer to 5. So, you know, put that in perspective.
Wow.
You know, that said, though, you know, I think the Fed is torn. They really don't want to raise rates. They feel that if they raise rates too soon, especially while other central banks are easing, that could send shockwaves through the financial markets, could potentially push the world toward a recession. On the other hand, if they wait too long, they run the risk of creating financial market bubbles, as we're seeing with the S&P reaching new highs every day. You know, we're seeing art now trading at, you know, Picasso's trading 160 some odd million. And so they are concerned. So, I think the course of action, that the Fed will likely continue to pursue is do nothing and let your gums do the work. In other words, you know, continue to be outspoken, on where you see excess. So we heard, Chairman Yellen comment about biotechs a few months ago. We heard Chairman Yellen comment about the market, recently. So my sense is, the more they flap their gums and try to talk some of the excess out of the market, the less they're going to have to actually do on the rate side. So we'll see.
Now, Britain apparently slipped into a deflationary environment for the first time since 1960. Earlier this week, and I know one of their concerns is that we could possibly slip into deflation. And if my understanding is correct, that the best way to combat deflation is to lower interest rates. Are they going to reload the gun just to make sure they can do that sometime in the future? Because I agree with you, they don't want to raise interest rates. It really wouldn't do them any good. And I don't think the economy really needs to have higher interest rates. We're not bubbling over here. Do you think they're going to increase the rates just so they can get some more arrows back in the quiver?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I mean, you know, combating deflation has become a pretty difficult thing to do. I think it's much easier to combat deflation in the NFL, where you can just simply suspend Tom Brady for a couple of games,
right.
But here, you know, in the financial markets, I think part of the Fed's premise, its entire financial strategy has been lower the borrowing costs, expand borrowing and use borrowing and incomes to expand the economy. The problem is with rates at zero, the Fed's, you know, flapping their arms and households are just not taking on debt. Since the financial crisis, mortgage balances collectively are down $1.1 trillion. Credit card balances are off probably $600 billion. And the only areas of debt growth that we're seeing are student loans and autos. And it helps, but so I'm not sure what what they can do in terms of trying to enhance our economy with borrowing. It just doesn't seem like that strategy that started in probably the mid 1980s is viable when rates are at zero.
Jack, why was it a surprise that the baby boomers didn't want to have a great deal of debt going into retirement? I don't know of any generation that has. And, you know, with the baby boomers coming to retirement, you know, they are paying down their debt. I don't know of anybody that wants to have a house that's got debt on it. I don't think anybody wants car payments, particularly with rates as earning rates as low as they are. You know, I guess if they were 7.5% CDs out there, people would be more comfortable having some debt. But with the low earnings rate that they get on their money, it would have seemed to me like both the government and the economists would have said, you know, these people are just going to pay down their debt. They're not going to expand the economy. Why is it? It appears to be a surprise, everybody. Yet to me, it makes perfectly good sense what the investing public is doing.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're absolutely right, Mike. I mean, when it comes to Fed policy, I have to suggest it's probably among the shortest term thinking in Washington. And that's, you know, and that's saying a lot considering, you know, how little Congress really does. But the probably the longest term thinker on the Fed as Fed governor was Paul Volcker back in the late 70s and early 80s, where in the face of double digit unemployment, Paul Volcker actually raised the overnight interest rates to pushing something like 20%. To finally break the back of inflation. Since that time, however, I will say that Alan Greenspan and the rest have really simply just swept dirt under the rug by lowering interest rates and patching over any imbalances that were out there. Now, you're absolutely right. You have two dynamics on the debt side. As you said, baby boomers hitting age 65 at a rate of $10,000 a day don't want to go into retirement with debt. And millennials, who may not have witnessed the housing crisis firsthand, certainly witnessed it through their parents' eyes, and are loath to take on debt right now. There appear to be a more sharing generation, a more renting generation. They don't want to own anything right now. And so taking on debt and getting locked down in any one particular place just seems to be, they're loath to that type of mentality. So, I think you're right. You call it the paradox of thrift. Americans are at long last doing the right thing, and the problem is the resulting organic economy that we have just doesn't satisfy policymakers, shareholders, management that want to see that growth.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because you say they're doing the right thing, and you're right. I think that the investing public is doing the right things for their personal situation. But everybody else sees it the wrong thing for the economy. You know, they say, okay, no, you need to be spending money because we need you to spend money, because if you don't spend money, then we can't outrageously spend our money. I tell you what, Jack, when we come back, what I'd like for you to do is give a grade on the monetary policy of this country. And I want to talk to you about one of the things that has driven both asset classes and markets, which is all these buybacks that we've seen from corporations. So that's what we'll do in the next section when we come back, folks. Stay with us. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, where we bring you the wisdom of Wall Street each and every day. Back in a minute.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Now, we've got one of our favorite guests on with us this morning, Mr. Jack Ablin. Jack is Executive Vice President and Chief Investment Officer with BMO Private Bank. And, Jack, before the break, I didn't get a chance to ask you, but what is your grade on the monetary policy? Obviously, monetary policy has had a great influence on the stock market, and one of the things that it's done is led to a lot of stock buybacks. So there's kind of a two-part, I guess, in that question. what grade do you give the monetary policy? Is this a situation we're going to be able to get out of? And then what's going on with these stock buybacks? Is that going to slow down or is that going to continue?
Yeah, I think they're both related, Mike. I think that, you know, the point that you made earlier, and I agree with, I would give it a pretty poor grade given how short-term thinking has been going on, has been motivated monetary policy. You know, every time the economy got the sniffles, they just, you know, try to lower interest rates and get to you know, a level that of lending that could support the growth that they wanted, whether that growth was really justified or not, given kind of the organic backdrop. Now, you know, with rates at zero, and now, you know, taking on a trillion, printing a trillion, $4.5 trillion in new money to help stimulate things, I think we're sort of reaching the end of the line on monetary policy. I don't think it will be effective anymore, unless we can see rates go up. And, you know, so far the Fed's been flapping their arms and they're not seeing inflation go up and they're not seeing borrowing go up. You know, I think we're going to have to take a different tack to help navigate the economy. And unfortunately, you know, that's probably focused on fiscal policy for the time being.
I agree. And these stock buybacks, which have had a big impact, I think, on the equity markets also. What are your thoughts about that? Are they going to continue?
Yeah, you know, I think the stock buybacks is really a personification of what the Fed has done, and that is they've created a wedge between the financial world and the real world. And while the financial world has done great, thanks in large part to the cheap money and relative undervaluation of equities to bonds, we've seen buybacks just skyrocket. And in fact, last time I checked, you know, with a dividend yield at around 2, buyback yield, if you just take the, you know, essentially reducing the denominator of the number of shares outstanding due to buybacks, I believe buyback yield is over 3. So it's been a huge boost for share values, but most notably management. You know, if you think about it, if I'm a manager of a company, and this is something that the NASDAQ companies perpetuated in the late 90s, you know, I have a lot of options. I want the price to go up. I don't care about my dividend. I don't get a dividend if I own options. I want the price of my company to go up. And so I think from that perspective, management prefers buybacks. That makes share prices rise. And then ultimately, it allows management to essentially take shares away from shareholders with these options that they have. In fact, in the late 90s, was the largest transfer of wealth in our nation's history was from shareholders to NASDAQ management because of the options that they had. So I think that's, you know, it's somewhat insidious, certainly perpetuated by Fed policy. And, you know, for that reason, I'd give it a C at best.
Okay, so that and plus it doesn't hurt management's personal profitability either. A lot of those guys have substantial bonuses dependent upon stock prices. I think that's had a big impact on in dividing the top 1% with the other 99%. But that's, I guess, more of a political argument. Anyway, I was reading your outlook for financial markets in June, and you did a fascinating study on something that there's been, you know, there's always these big arguments about these sayings on Wall Street, and, you know, whether or not they're viable, whether or not they make any sense. But there is one that's pretty popular, and that's sell in May and go away. And you did a fascinating amount of research. Can you share that with the folks?
Sure. Yeah. We decided to test it. You know, sell in May, go away. Essentially what we did was we divided the Dow Jones into 2 6-month periods. We said, let's invest November through April, and then let's invest in a separate portfolio May through October, essentially 2 6-month periods, and then link them together. We went all the way back to 1900, linked these two portfolios together, and came up with astounding results. Since 1900, a May through October portfolio, in other words, you invest in May, you sell in October and then wait and then invest in May again. $1,000 invested in 1900 accumulated to $2,402. Now, that's no dividends, just price only. Essentially, you know, 2.5 times roughly since 1900. That same portfolio invested November through April, starting in $1,900, accumulated to over $134,000.
Wow!
Wow!
So it outpaced the other portfolio by something like 72,000 times. So, or I should say 72 times. Sorry. So it's a, you know, it's an astounding difference. And what I found interesting was those two portfolios ran neck and neck till roughly 1960. So really the view is from 1960 forward, the entire difference in the May through October portfolio versus the November through April portfolio has transpired. So the question is, all right, well, if I can understand what happened, what caused that spread, especially starting in 1960, you know, we've got a secret ingredient we can use to perhaps make some money or at least avoid some losses. Unfortunately, I can't explain it. Now, if you look over the last, and so if you ask me, should we be selling in May this year? Now, I can tell you over the, you know, since 2010, I kind of divided it into decades, the May through October portfolio has consistently underperformed the November through April portfolio every year since 2010. The problem is, 2013 and 14, even though they underperformed, the May through October portfolio delivered roughly a 6% return in 2013 and a 5% return in 2014. So if the control group is cash, then you're better off staying in the market.
Yeah, you're right, because if your control group is cash, that's the biggest problem. If you come out of the market, you go to cash and pays practically nothing. All right, we've got less than a minute to go. I'm going to just ask you a simple question since you're a top strategist there for BMO. What are you telling your clients now? Where should they invest?
Well, it's really, really tough. I think it's probably among the hardest decisions. Those that are in the market should stay in the market. We're monitoring momentum. It is an expensive market. Those who have cash and they're looking to get in, probably better serve looking for buying dips.
Okay. All right. Just like we got in the energy sector. Jack, thank you so much. We appreciate it very much. I hope you and your family have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.